Welcome, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the All In Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Eli Cooper, joined by my other co-host, Mike Badzik. How's it going today, man?
It's going good, and congratulations are in order for my co-host. If you don't know, my man got big news, so congratulations.
Yeah, got engaged Monday. So Monday we dropped a new podcast, and your boy got engaged. So not a bad day at all. Not a bad day.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but thank you, man. Appreciate it. But today we have a special guest coming on. My guy, Fore McGlynn, a 717 hoops legend, played at Dallastown High School, and graduated in 2011, mm-hmm. Went on to play Division I basketball at Vermont, Towson, and Rhode Island, and is now playing overseas, spent 2 years in Portugal, and is now playing in Spain's second division, which is pretty tough level competition. So. Yeah. He also just recently played with Sideline Cancer in the TBT tournament. Their Cinderella run that they had ended in the final. They lost to Marquette's alumni team, which was a pretty tough team. Mm-hmm. So we're going to bring Fore in, and while we do that, listen in to a word from our sponsors.
With the NBA playoffs coming back, something we're going to be seeing a lot is every player's fresh new cut. But you know what else needs a fresh new cut? Your lawn. That's why you should hit up Tavon's Lawn Care. Tavon's Lawn Care LLC is a black family-owned business located in York, Pennsylvania. Tavon's Lawn Care, or TLC for short, since they provide each job with tender love and care, has been in business for over 10 years. Founded by owner Tavon Parker, TLC aims to provide employment for underprivileged youth while providing great service at a reasonable rate. Visit Tavon's Lawn Care LLC for Tavon's Lawn Care on Facebook and Instagram to view their portfolio and request your cost-free quote today.
All right, welcome back. As you can see, our special guest is here with us today, my guy, Fore McGlynn. How's it going, bro?
Good, man. Appreciate you guys having me.
Sure.
Yeah, man, we appreciate you coming on. So we wanted to, you know, get a little insight to our viewers, man, about your playing career, talk a little bit about some of the things you've gone on to do. Most recently got to play in the TBT tourney and went all the way to the final. So we'll get to that a little bit later. But start a little bit with your experience at Dallastown. You know, you, me and you, we played in the same era, same league. You were a year ahead of me in that time, and you were the all-time leading scorer at Dallastown, right?
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about your experience there, what that was like, and than your, you know, eventual commitment to Vermont.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was kind of cool. You know, we'll talk about it probably as it goes on, but, like, my basketball career has been kind of all over the place. So high school is actually the first time where I actually, you know, got to, like, build a bond with, like, people for more than a year or so. Mm-hmm. I moved back to York and I think it was like fifth grade. So high school was cool for me because everybody I grew up with, from like rinks and whatever the others ended up being, you know, all the way through middle school and up to high school, we all played together the whole time. So that was like, it was like a blast for me. And you know, it didn't hurt that we were, you know, pretty good. I think we were the first team under Coach Rexroth, who he ended up retiring. I think he coaches the women's team now.
Okay.
We were the first team to win a district game, and then I'm pretty sure we were the first team in Dallastown, I don't know if it was Dallastown history, to win a state game. You know, my senior year was a lot of fun. Yeah, I think we started like 18-0. Obviously played Chester, who, you know, have Rondé Jefferson and Jameer Nelson's little brother, so got stopped a little short, but I definitely had some fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, you know, Dallastown was, like, wasn't as good, you know what I mean, traditionally before you came up, and you came up with, like, a good, you know, group of guys, like, all at the same time. You had, like, a kind of young Manny Masengo, you know, mm-hmm. Judd Gimmel, guys like that came through.
So being, you know, in the leadership role on that team, what was that like, you know, trying to, you know, elevate the rest of your teammates' play so that you guys could, you know, make those kind of runs and have that kind of history?
Yeah, I mean, the leadership stuff didn't really, like, I didn't really have to do a whole lot, honestly. Like, I mean, scoring-wise and everything else, obviously that kind of came with, you know, just being, like, a good player in high school. But when you're talking about the young guys that we had, like you mentioned Judd and Manny, like, it didn't take a whole lot to get them motivated because they played for, like, the York Ballers, the team underneath of mine. So, you know, they're used to, like, a certain level of competitiveness that they have to bring all the time.
Right.
So we had a lot of really, like, high-intense practices, like, and then you obviously have guys who, you know, like Ford and Alda played basketball in college. You know, Corey Ebersole was, you know, played really, really hard. And then we had guys like Eric Thomas and Ben Klein who both played Division I sports. Eric played baseball and Ben obviously went to Penn State for football. So you had guys who were, you know, at the time and like ever since then, we haven't really seen it where we had three, four Division I athletes, not basketball, but like that level of like competitiveness and athleticism is something like you don't see a whole lot. So like they kind of brought, everybody brought their own little edge to the table. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a whole lot of like rah-rah stuff we had to do to get guys motivated.
That's awesome. And then, so you ended up going to Vermont then, which D1 school, you know, like Vermont, like I think we might say that at first people were like, oh, well, what's Vermont? But like they're a power in the America East Conference. And like, so talk about the recruitment process and then what made you choose Vermont and end up going there?
Yeah, so, you know, I had a lot of success playing AAU, which, you know, Eli, you know how important that is.
Yep.
You know, if you play games on the winner's bracket on Sundays, that really helps your stock.
Yep.
But, you know, we went and played in the championship game of a lot of really high tournaments. You know, we went pretty far in like the West Virginia, like the Harley Davidson tournaments. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we ever won the Albany, like the Gym Rats thing, but we always played in like the late 5 o'clock Sunday games. So that kind of helped me out. But I had offers all over the place. But we actually went to, it was funny, we went to Vermont after we had played in Albany because it was kind of fairly close.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking at me and then like Steve Zach and then I'm pretty sure Donovan Jack too, who played at Berks Catholic. I don't know if you remember him at all.
Yep.
Ended up going to Penn State. So I kind of liked the idea that I might be able to play with somebody that I know. Now, obviously, right, it didn't work out that way, but, like, a lot of people don't know that, like, when you go up to that campus, like, there's not really a whole lot around, but it's, like, it's hard to describe. Like, it was just beautiful. Like, there's beaches everywhere, which you wouldn't think about.
Right, yeah.
And then another thing is I wanted to go somewhere. I don't want to go somewhere where, like, you get 50 fans a game. Mm-hmm. Like, right, they sell out every single home game.
Yeah.
And then winning was a part, too. Like you said, they're a big American East powerhouse. They win or are right there to win the league every year. And for one big leagues like that, like that's like an important thing that I looked at. And, you know, we went to the NCAA tournament my freshman year, which is, you know, it was really cool how it worked out.
Yeah. And like, that's how I know Vermont. Like I don't watch America East basketball typically normally during the week, but during like conference championship week, I'm tuned into a lot of those tournaments and it's like Vermont is like 1, 2, maybe 3 seed. And they're always playing in front of a sellout crowd looking to secure an NCAA tournament bid. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So like you said, you guys got a tournament bid and for you, you guys, you had a play-in game or one of the first round games and then ended up playing UNC in the second round. But one of the big things that, you know, I remember, I was a senior in high school then, was you were the leading scorer in that first round game that, you know, you guys eventually went on to win. Announcers were calling it McGlynn's sanity as you came off the bench and were the leading scorer. So talk a little bit about, you know, that experience and, you know, what playing in that game was like and hearing stuff like that, afterwards.
Yeah. So it was kind of cool. it was actually like a funny story because it wasn't like for me, it hadn't been that big of a deal because we actually lost. We lost to Binghamton. Like, people don't know this going into our conference tournament. Oh, wow. Binghamton was 0-28 when we lost to them.
Really? Wow.
So when you're the number one seed in the America East, as long as you get out of the first two games, like they have a neutral site. Well, it wasn't then, but they do now. And whoever the higher seed is for the championship game gets home court advantage. So you play at like the home gym. So leading into that, we lost two games before the conference tournament. So we were actually supposed to host the championship game. Ended up having to go and win on the road, which was crazy in itself. But then we played, Elijah, you might know because I know you really follow basketball. Is Mike? We played Mike James in the playing game, who's the best point guard in Europe right now.
Yeah, yeah. I remember him.
Yeah. So we're watching film, and, like, they don't look great. Like, they're kind of a small school like us. But then they showed, like, his stat line from their conference championship. He had 55 and, like, 9 rebounds and 4 assists or something ridiculous like that. Yeah. So – I mean, it was pretty cool because we played – I can't remember who played before us, but they had, like, a fairly packed gym at Dayton, and then it was almost sold out for ours too. But, I mean, we – you know, they were okay. They weren't great, but, like, so we kind of got that game out of the way. But we had already had, like, a whole big media thing behind it because we had won on the road at Stony Brook, and there were only – there were like 5 to 10 teams that had ever done that in the history of that conference who'd won on the road.
Right.
We kind of had that whole, like, okay, we got the hardest part out of the way.
Right.
And then we go win that game. And then that's kind of like where all like the freedom came too, because, you know, then we play North Carolina, who's the overall number one seed. Like, we're not even supposed to be at this. Like, we were thankful just to be in the tournament. And then we'd already game too, which was kind of cool. So we go down to Carolina, play the Greensboro Coliseum in front of like 20,000 people. Maybe got beat pretty. I think it ended up only being like 19 or 20. But I know there was one point where we had like 18 or 19 points at halftime. It was not looking good.
So, yeah, talk a little bit about that experience because, you know, that's a whole different level of basketball when you're playing against guys like that. So – what was like playing against that kind of size, that kind of athleticism like?
Yeah, it was different. So we played against, like, South Florida was my first game in college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have 3 or 4 guys that year that were flirting with the NBA.
Right.
We played St. Louis at one point, who was a top 25 team at the time. So I thought that was crazy in itself. You know, we went to St. Louis and we got smacked by, like, 30. Then, you know, fast forward to North Carolina when you have, I think, 8 or 9 of their guys got drafted. Something either like that year or the year after. Like, they had Kendall Marshall, Harrison Barnes. Like,
yeah, that's back when they were loaded.
It's, like, the size, too. Like, people don't think how crazy, like, it is. But you got guys like Harrison Barnes who are 6'8", like, 230 playing the two, like, in college.
Right.
Like, Reggie Bullock guarded me. He doesn't play a ton in the league now, but he was, like, 6'6", like 6'6", or 6'7".
Right.
Like, just that experience was super different.
That's awesome. So, after your first season at Vermont, you ended up transferring back to Towson. I know locally that was, like, some big news that was in the paper because of the reason that you transferred. So, what was, you know, went into that and – you know, what was went into your decision in transferring to Towson?
Yeah, so, I mean, my grandfather had been sick, and it was kind of far away. Now, for me, it wasn't, but, like, you know, I know how your family is, too. Like, you're used to having, you know, somebody at every game.
Yeah.
And, you know, for my parents to drive, you know, 10 hours to Vermont, 10 hours back, like, it's a lot.
Right.
So – it was like I'm looking down the schedule sometimes thinking like, okay, cool. We play – ironically, we played Towson the day before Christmas. So, you know, I kind of knew what was going on down there, whatever. I knew they had some really high-level transfers sitting out.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I was looking down the schedule like, all right, cool. Albany's, you know, 5 hours, which isn't super close, but, like, you know, it's close enough where I might be able to have some people come.
Right.
I mean, but other than that, like, that conference is super, super, like, Northeastern, like dominant. Yeah. So my parents are going to have to drive 7-8 games no matter where we play, right, unless it's UMBC, but we only play them once a year.
Right.
So that was, like, kind of what played into it. And then, obviously, that recruiting was crazy because of being the rookie of the year. You know, I was the only person in the country that year to lead their team in scoring and not start a game.
Wow.
Yeah, which was strange to me. I didn't really understand that. I mean, I kind of get it. If I don't know if he wanted you to come into like a Lou Will kind of role, you know what I mean? Where you're right, just, your score is coming off the bench, which isn't normally the case in college basketball. But
right,
I thought that was so strange.
Yeah, it was a little different. Because the guy, now I love this dude to death. We actually played when I was in Maryland, we played on the same AAU team. So the year before I got there, his name is Brendan Bald. He actually was the defensive player of the year in the conference.
Gotcha.
And he's like a 6'5", like shooting guard. So like I understood that whole, and he was a junior.
Mm-hmm.
So like I kind of understood, like, yeah, I'm a freshman, I got to earn my stripes. But like I used to get frustrated because at some point I'm like, all right, like I can't keep going and getting 15, 18, 20 points in 15 or 18 minutes. And like, you know, now right, I got leads at the end of the year. So like that ended up, you know, being, you know, that kind of like alleviated some of that like frustration. But yeah, so I ended up transferring and, you know, Towson was cool. Like it was a cool area. It was close to home and they actually were building, it's called the CQ Arena now. And they showed me like the blueprint for or whatever, and it looked awesome. Mm-hmm. And now I hadn't actually visited any schools that had these facilities except for Penn State at the time. So yeah, I transferred to Towson and played. I sat out a year and then played 2 years there.
Mm-hmm. And then you left there, right? And then so that was your longest stint. And then eventually you ended up at Rhode Island. So just keep going with this then, I guess.
Yeah, so actually I'm assuming you guys have both seen Space Jam with Bill Murray.
Yeah, of course.
So Bill's son Luke was actually the one that recruited me to go to Towson. He left after my redshirt year and went to Rhode Island. So when they found out I wanted to transfer, because I didn't, like, I enjoyed playing there, but I also knew in terms of, you know, getting a professional career, and you kind of want to be somewhere like, yeah, we're going to win 20 games. But like, I wanted to play somewhere that like we had a legitimate chance to make a run in the tournament. So I was looking at, you know, Iona, who goes to the tournament every year, mm-hmm. Rhode Island, obviously, who now, as everybody knows, is a really, really good team. And then I had Purdue, I can't remember where else. But like all three of those teams, like, just, you know, have made the tournament every year or almost every year since I have made that decision to leave. So Luke recruited me to Rhode Island. We were, you know, had some preseason top 25 votes and then just had a crazy year with injuries. You know, we had a point guard who was supposed to get drafted, 6'5", left-handed, tore his ACL 5 minutes into the first game. We had Allen Iverson's nephew who transferred from Memphis, who was really good. We had a guy who he was like a defensive All-American, fractured his kneecap. So there were games, like, we played Brown one before Christmas break with 5 scholarship players.
Wow.
So it ended up, you know, it didn't work out, but it was a great experience, you know, just being able to play at such a high level.
That's awesome. So, you know, obviously you finished up your career at Rhode Island. I think for your career, you hovered around 11 points per game. Obviously, you know, had some great accolades, got to play in the tournament. And then eventually, over the last couple of years, you've been playing overseas. You played 2 years in Portugal, and now you're out in Spain. So what was your time like in Portugal? What's the, you know, the country like? What was it like playing basketball in another country?
You know, it's been fun. So I actually played a summer in India too. And the only way to say that is and like the people hate it, but Portugal and Spain were like extremely similar to me. Mm-hmm. Now they're right next to each other. You know, everything about it is, you know, for me, it's fairly similar. You know, the culture, the people are all relatively nice. The climate, I was, my first year, I actually lived on an island. So it was like 70 year round. I had lived, looked outside my house, had a beach.
Not bad at all.
Yeah, not at all.
I mean, really the only thing is like, is when people are getting yelled at, or like, you know, we have a bad game and they come in and they're starting to like yell in Portuguese or Spanish. Like,
oh yeah.
Like we're kind of, the Americans are kind of just like sitting around waiting to hear like what they're talking about.
Secondary then, like, instruction.
Right. So they stand us next to, you know, the most, you know, bilingual Spanish or Portuguese player. And then still, oh like gosh, with that translation, like sometimes I'm just like, there's no way that that's what they were saying. And like, they're like, and there's nothing against them. They're trying their best to, you know, to try and tell us what's going on or whatever.
Right.
But there's something that's lost in all that. So yeah, like I'm missing a lot of the message, but I mean, it's really cool. Like, especially like to embrace like the different like styles of play. Like Portugal is more like AAU. You have more Americans. You know, we're scoring in the 90s, the hundreds every game. And then you go to Spain where you're scoring 60, 65, and you pay, you're playing everybody who runs basically a Princeton offense, for lack of a better way to describe it.
And you were getting buckets in Portugal. I mean, I don't know about Spain, but I know I watched a lot of Portugal highlights. It looked like you were really getting buckets there. Like, what was that like against competition?
24 my first year and 21 my second year.
That's what I saw, man. So what's that like, kind of going from, you're always playing in America AAU and you always are one of the best players on the court. You go D1, you still are Rookie of the Year in America East, and then new challenge, go overseas. Okay, I'm still getting buckets. What's that like?
Yeah, so the level of play, like, I don't, it's not, it sounds super judgmental, right? But pretty much anywhere that I could go and play pickup in America, you know, maybe outside of like LA Fitness, but if it's like organized pickup, generally the level of play, or at least the talent, is always generally a little bit higher than what you have to see overseas because it's all Americans.
Right.
Right. So when you go over there, like, Portugal's, you know, 4 or 5, depending on what team's budgets are, how many Americans they can afford to bring. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're expected to go and just hoop and get buckets. Like, if that's, especially for me, like, I was never a pass first point guard. So I'm going over there shooting 15, 20 shots a game.
Nice. Like,
and that's the thing too. It's really cutthroat. Like, if you don't, you get a couple of weeks, like, you don't go in shape, like, you go right back home. Mm. But in Spain, it was a lot more, like, of a system. We played 13 players every game.
13, wow.
Yeah, jeez. So I played 13 minutes a game, 14. I averaged almost 10 points in 13 minutes or something like that.
Wow.
So wow. I guess, you know, if I'm playing 40, it ends up averaging out to, like, 24, 25. But like,
Yeah.
That's, they just don't do it that way.
MVP levels if you get 36 minutes a game.
Right.
And this is kind of, like, a common theme that I usually hear from people who play overseas, especially in Europe. And once you get into those, like, tougher divisions, especially when – like Luka Doncic, for example, you know, had said it was way tougher for him to score in Europe than it was in the NBA. Not because the NBA doesn't have more talented players, but like you said, they're running like systems and playing 13 to 14 guys a game. So like Luka's not averaging 30 in Spain, even, you know, with the same skill set, but it's because the play style is so different. You know what I mean? Obviously that has a lot of an impact. And that's kind of something we talked about, Mike, on our last episode. It's not that the NBA doesn't play defense. Right. It's that their play style is so, like, dramatically different than what you'll see everywhere else. It encourages scoring. So it's a whole different, you know, ball game. It's not really an effort or, an effort or thing defensively. It's really more of a strategic thing and how the game is actually played. And that's one thing that I noticed, and that kind of stands out from what you're saying, is that, you know, you're running – backdoor cuts and lots of like motion offenses and stuff like that, rather than just playing like free flowing basketball.
Right. And Luka Doncic, even when he played, good, qualify for.
That's what I was going to say. Like, even, like, if you look at, like, Lucas' thing or, you know, some of them, you're looking at the guys, like, he's playing at the highest level in Europe, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, he's playing in the ACB in Spain, so they're doing some stuff where, like you said, they're only playing 15, 20 minutes a game. So it's not the NBA where, you know, you're talking about LeBron's playing 40 minutes. So something in his game has got to give. Right. Has been a defense. In Europe, you're playing – if you're only playing 20 minutes, you're picking up 94 feet. Like, there's no excuse for you not to give everything on both ends.
Yeah.
So that also makes it harder to score too.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you see guys like Giannis, and he takes 3-4 dribbles down the court and is getting a dunk, but doesn't do that in I don't remember the last thing. Was it the world qualifiers or whatever? Like
World Cup. Well, and Greece was pretty awful just as a team in general. But, like, yeah, he struggled because it's a different ball game. The floor spacing isn't the same. It's much European basketball is more physical as well. You know, so it's not quite the same environment. Yeah, he did get a lot of flack after that World Cup because he wasn't great. And that
I couldn't believe that, because then, like, you got all these NBA guys who are like, I mean, you see, like, I know you're on Twitter a lot. Like, you see these guys, like, oh, why don't they do that in the league? Like, because they can't guard him in the league, but then they do this in the World Cup stuff, and just, like, it doesn't work like that. Like, they can't. Right. There's defensive 3 seconds. You know, you're getting European bigs too, are huge.
Yeah.
You know, like Porzingis and guys like that don't come around. Like, these guys are 6'8", 260, and just clogging up the paint.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the basket interference rule is different in Europe too. Like, it's not the same. Where I think they're allowed to do more of that goaltending stuff.
Yeah, like, you can pin. I think it's the goaltending is kind of the same. Where if it's above the level of the rim and it hits the backboard, you can't touch it. Mm-hmm. But if it's below the rim, you can pin it. If it's rolling around the rim, you can knock it off.
That's what I meant. You can knock it off the rim. Yeah.
So it just adds something a little different. I don't know. You know, with him, he kind of dunks everything around the rim, so that doesn't really have a whole lot to affect his game. Right. But just, it is different, though. I mean, they did change the lane and stuff now, so it's not, you know, like when Vince Carter jumped over the dude in that weird trapezoid. It's not like that anymore, but.
Okay. So and your season got cut a little short this year, right? Because of the COVID thing. So talk a little bit about that, like when it happened, what was like your league's procedure, and because you were kind of stuck in Spain for a little bit, weren't you?
Yeah, so we had actually just gotten back from a game. I can't remember who we played, but we were like on the way back, and it was like two back-to-back bad trips for us, because the first trip we come back, we find out about the whole Kobe Bryant situation. Get on the bus, and that's what everyone's talking about is, you know, did you see TMZ? Did you, you know, whatever. So that was crazy, right?
Yeah.
And the next trip, literally, we are on the way back, right? So the way the Spanish league is after you play everybody, it breaks into the top six of each side. There's a north and a south. And basically, you play your first set of playoff games against the top six from the other side. So we're on the way back, whatever. We hear about it, but they hadn't really said a lot, even though Spain was, I guess, the second or third worst country in the world at that time.
Yeah.
So we actually try and go to practice on Monday. They call us, say, yeah, we can't do anything right now. So we were kind of, like, confused. And then the next day, I'm trying to go to the grocery store, and we're getting stopped by police on the street. Like, yeah, you guys we're in full lockdown unless you're going to the grocery store. So we were there for 2.5 weeks. Couldn't leave the house unless we were going to the grocery store. Didn't touch a ball for that whole time. And then my agent had called me and was like, look, like, we might risk losing, I guess it was 2 months of the season for, like, the salary. But on the other hand, they might close the travel borders and you might be stuck in Spain, you know, indefinitely.
Right.
So, you know, I guess credit to the team. You know, they got all the Americans out the same day. I guess everybody had talked about it on Friday. We left on Saturday. But even that was bad. Like, I had a flight, so we had to drive to Madrid. It was 5 hours. I had to wait 12 hours just to get on my flight. Then I fly to JFK. So New York at this time is like, I mean, it still kind of is. It was like a hot box for the disease.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You ever seen, I always make this joke. You ever seen Monsters, Inc. when the dude Sully comes out and has the sock on his back?
Yeah.
Right. That's what it looked like. They had people walking around the airport in hazmat suits, and like, it was crazy.
Wow.
So then I had like a 12-hour layover there too, because my parents, you know, with my dad being a cop, they thought, you know, maybe he could take, you know, a police car or something to New York and just get me, because it's 5 hours. So that didn't work. So I flew for like 2 days maybe, got home, and then had to obviously do the self-quarantine thing for 2 weeks before I could, you know, see anybody or do anything outside of the house.
Wow. And then how long was it until you got the call about TBT?
I got the call about TBT 5 days before the TBT started.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for TBT, you played for Charlie Parker, another local 717 legend, played at Kennerdale High School, and went on to play at Millersville, and actually coached at Millersville, I think, if he's not still, I'm not sure if he's still on the staff there.
He's not anymore.
I didn't think so.
He runs Crunch Time Hoops, so he has his own brand for workouts and, you know, everything like that.
Gotcha. So is he the one who gave you the invite to come play?
Yeah, so actually I was relatively familiar with them because my dad knows the guy, Billy Clapper, who's at, I want to say
Du Bois, right? Or maybe he was at Penn State Du Bois?
Yeah, he was at a Penn State school. And then left. But so my dad actually knows him. I was supposed to play with them. I might have been 3 years ago. The summer I ended up going to India, so I couldn't.
Okay.
So they actually had some guys. We had an issue with, like, the testing and some other stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So Charlie calls me and was like, hey, have you been around people? Have you, you know, all the, I guess, normal questions? Because then the follow-up is, do you think you have the virus?
Right.
And I said, no, I definitely don't, because my brother works people out, and he gets the nose, the brain test or whatever.
Oh, man.
So if he doesn't have it, I definitely don't. Right. That's kind of where it started. And then he was like, well, if you could drive there and we can get this cleared, like, would you want to come? So that's kind of how it all came together.
Nice.
That's cool.
So, yeah, talk a little bit about your tournament experience, because you guys were like the 22nd seed or something like that, and end up going all the way to the final in the tournament and lost to a tough Marquette team. But talk a little bit about your experience playing in the tournament, what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool. You know, like, obviously I've been playing pickup, you know, here and there, but yeah, obviously not, you know, to the level of what it was when I got there. You know, everybody that I played with is, you know, playing at some of the highest leagues in Europe and Asia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just that in itself was cool. But yeah, the 22 seed was kind of crazy. We were making jokes about it because after last year, they actually lost to the Marquette team in the regional semifinal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when the tournament ended, supposedly they got ranked as like the 7th or 8th best team. Now, with the way the virus happened, I guess it kind of screwed up some seedings.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, obviously we ended up playing, you know, some of the best, like, Team Hines was really good. Team Challenge ALS had, you know, some really high level guys. And then obviously, you know, we played Syracuse, who surprisingly, right, in terms of all the teams we played, that was the easiest game.
Right.
And then we obviously play Overseas Elite, and then, you know, it happened in the championship game. But, you know, it was just really cool to see what sports might look like, right? Because some of these countries that still have, you know, are still afflicted by the virus, you kind of only have to imagine that, like, that's what your games are going to be.
Yeah.
So kind of like a close scrimmage in high school. That's kind of what I had described it to most people as. Because, like, you kind of – now, it was kind of hard to do, right? But, like, you kind of have to watch what you say because there's no fans to block out, you know, the dialogue between players and refs. Like,
right.
So that was kind of the only difference because I remember I had said something one time during the Syracuse game, and the ref looked at me and, like, went like this and pointed to the microphone that was on his shirt. And I was like, oh, my bad. Got it.
Yeah, see, and they were the NBA had said they were going to play, or as far as like what you see on TV was going to be like a couple seconds delayed, so they like bleep that stuff out. I was like, nah, man, let us hear about the bombs. You know?
Well, I was really excited, like whenever they put out the Dream Team like tape when the Jordan doc, and you could hear like all the players talking shit and different stuff, not only talking shit but talking some strategy and stuff. But like, I really wanted to hear that stuff. I thought it would have been really cool. But what was the because you guys were in like a bubble, right? You guys were kind of the test dummies, I think, for the NBA's model of now the bubble. So what was it like being in a bubble? How did they work out?
What'd you do?
Yeah, so I assume it's fairly similar, obviously, with guys that are in the NBA. And, you know, it being the – I can't even remember how many teams are down there. 16, right?
22.
Yeah. Right, so you got to think you got all the best players there. So you got LeBron and James Harden and Westbrook who are probably going to get a little bit different treatment than, you know, everybody in our bubble got the exact same. Right.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, credit to them. It was cool. Like when you get there, you got to take a test. You can't leave until it comes back, which it comes back in 18 hours. But you know, you have to wear a mask. You got to like, you know, sanitize and stuff, obviously. And then they built 4 or 5 courts inside of the hotel we were staying at. And then every court had a weight room and 5 exercise bikes. So we got 2 practice slots every day. So you get either like shoot around in the mornings, optional, or you can go lift. And then you do like your regular practice at night. And then they catered 3 meals a day. So I had breakfast, lunch, and dinner for you. They paid for everything. So it was really cool the way they ran it. Cause like I was used to it from Spain, so it wasn't a big deal, but like just knowing that we had 2 times to practice every day kind of made it a little easier. Cause you know, they kind of had something to look forward to.
Yeah. They had a lot of success with the, you know, the bubble. I was watching on ESPN, and in those games, like they talk about the procedures and everything like that, and showed like the test results from the first round all the way through. Mm-hmm. I think when you guys were watching Syracuse, I think you were at, by that point, the whole tournament was at 0 cases. Yeah. And the NBA has had success with it as well. They're sitting at 0 cases right now too. So it's good to see, you know, that they were able to, you know, have these events and stuff like that while keeping everybody safe, you know, and healthy. So talk a little bit about, cause I saw an article, I think, I can't remember what news publication it was around here, where you talked about the Elam ending, mm-hmm. Which is, for those listening in, that's where you play like 3 quarters of regular basketball. And then at the end, it's kind of what they did in the All-Star game. It's where they have a set score that you get to, you know, so talk a little bit about the difference in that, what it's like playing under, you know, those kind of rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of different because, I mean, you know, like you have stall offenses and, you know, especially in PA where you don't have a shot clock in high school.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember when we were AAU, we ran stall offenses for 3-4 minutes just to run the game out.
Yeah.
But I think I kind of told the reporter the same thing. Like, it kind of throws out everything you've been cultured to learn about late game situations and everything like that. So mm-hmm. when you get to a point where like you see some of these teams struggling, like you got to have, you know, you could be like a Princeton, right? And right. your game plan works for the first, what would it be? 27-6. So the first 33 minutes, right? You might have the greatest game plan.
Right.
But once that Elam hits, right, and you got to get 8 points,
right.
that other team, that's all they have to do is catch up and then score that 8. Like you have to have some really good, like just flat out hoopers to be successful, which, you know, we had like Marcus Keene, who was unbelievable, right? And we had like Mo Creek, who made some big shots. And so like, that was kind of cool to be a part of, because it's winning a game that way is way more exciting than winning a game by 30, because every game has a buzzer beater essentially.
Yeah. And that's honestly, that's why I like it. And I hope the All-Star game keeps that forever, because, you know, especially when you see it down a stretch, like the defense, all right, we got to hold, you know, 8 points in this situation, or this amount of points, we got to keep them from getting to this number. The defensive intensity just goes through the roof. You know what I mean? When you know there's a set amount of points, it's like pickup basketball. Like when you get to, you play into 11 or whatever, and somebody gets the 9 or 10, you know what I mean? That's when everybody starts playing defense and whatnot. So, or just flat out hacking. So it's like
a super LA fitness thing to say, right?
Yeah.
You're playing a game to 11 and you get to 9 or 10, you're not getting a shot up for 15.
Yo, that is the worst, man. Especially because we play at the same LA fitness. You know, you essentially, you got to get the 9 and then hit a contested 2, because you go by somebody, you're getting wrapped up immediately. There's no layups once you get to 9 or 10 in LA fitness. And that's, it's beyond annoying.
To the wall.
Yeah, exactly. So you gotta have a step back or a deep three in your bag, or you're not hitting any game winners.
But it also, like, people don't know, right? Like, you talk about the defense just when the Elam thing starts, right? But really, in the second half, once it starts, like, everything is kind of geared to what you're preparing for in that Elam ending. So, like, in the first half, like, you obviously want to play defense. You want to, you know, hoop, whatever. But, like, in the second half, like, I remember there were times when they're like, honestly, just give up a 2. I guess it would be kind of similar to LA Fitness, right? Because, like, threes are going to end up beating you, like, at the end of the game.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Like, you can make 2 twos or you can make 2 threes or 4 twos, right, and essentially be in the same spot. Because, you know, in the fourth quarter, right, you're going to get fouled. So you're probably somewhat near the bonus, especially halfway through the quarter.
Right.
So there's probably a free throw or two in there. So you might only need 2 shots to win the game. So, like, it kind of changes how you approach it even before that, like, 4 minute mark would hit, which was kind of cool. Like, it was super different.
That's awesome. Yeah. See, I'm a fan of it. I like it, especially in like tournament type situations and stuff like that. I think it brings a lot of excitement, especially when you factor in like pretty much every, like you said, every game's ending on a game winner. I think that makes it like 10 times more exciting to watch. So,
yeah.
So NBA is back. Exhibition games actually started today. I don't know if you were able to catch any of those. I think Clippers and Magic kicked off the day, and then Denver trotted out a 5-center lineup today. But with the NBA coming back, who's your pick to win it all?
See, I don't know how they – I have to look at the schedule, right? Because, like, you got guys like LeBron who, you know, have the money to have facilities at their house. So, you know, you see him in the first day back, right? He looks like he's still in midseason shape.
Yep.
If you only play 2 exhibition games or 3, like, some guys still aren't going to be in game shape or have that, you know, the flow that they had. So, honestly, I think – and I thought before it ended that the Lakers were going to win it. You know, they just added JR. You know, some of their practices, I don't know if you guys follow, like, Swish Cultures or, like, some other stuff on Instagram. Like, they look pretty good. So, I still think that they're gonna win it. LeBron was just playing at such a high level. And, like, for him to look like that after however many weeks or months they had off, like, I just think that that gives them an edge.
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus. Me and Mike both have the Lakers as our pick too, and pretty much everyone we've brought on is going with the Lakers. So I think that's a strong pick, and definitely I think JR helps. You know, with some of the players that they lost, like Avery Bradley, Rondo, stuff like that. You know, they made some good signings to help replace those guys. So, and like you said, it's going to be interesting to see how guys come off of quarantine, because, like you said, the guys who have facilities and stuff like that are going to be obviously in the best shape, and just like their skill level isn't they're not going to be as rusty essentially because they've been able to work on their games. So we might see like a big gap between like star players, you know, the guys with the max contracts and stuff like that who are able to afford that stuff versus like role players, you know, and all that stuff goes into a championship. So it's important. So that's
yeah, you saw Russell Westbrook's first highlight, right? They put him on everything. His first highlight in practice was a dunk. Like he looks at, he's still in mid-season form. And then you see like Jokic is on House of Highlights or whatever right now. His first highlight was him throwing a no-look turnover off of Shabazz Napier's face. They played the Wizards, which was – I thought it was only teams that were close to being in the playoffs, but I guess maybe in the East they might be around.
They're the next closest.
Yeah, so they're the only team outside the top eight in the East that got invited, but they're 5.5 games back. It's – they're probably not going to make the playoffs,
right?
Essentially, because they get 8 games to try to catch up that difference. And without Brad Beal, that's probably not going to happen.
Right, because John Wall's not playing either, right?
Yeah, no John Wall, right. No Brad Beal. It's doubtful that happens.
It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough.
And that's why I kind of thought that was a surprising team because, like, what's the purpose of bringing them? They don't have not just one of their superstars. They don't have both.
Right.
Like, yeah, they can't because – because that playoff intensity is way different. And, like, if you don't have a dog, like, you're not going to be able to compete at all.
No. Yeah, and that's something. That's, like, when we first talked about this, that was the first thing that I said was get the Wizards out of here. Why? It's just adding more teams to the bubble. It doesn't make any sense. So when you went to the bubble, like you were saying about guys who have been working and guys who maybe haven't been working, could you tell when you were on the court, like, that guy's been working through quarantine, or that guy's a little rusty, or maybe you didn't know the guy's good enough?
On my team, I couldn't really tell.
Yeah.
But, like, when you're watching some of the games, like you can tell because, like you know, when you work out by yourself, you can only push yourself so hard.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? So, like even guys who are in workout shape, like, playing in a game is way different, which is why you saw like some of those games, those first round games, like they're having 6 to 8 turnovers in one quarter, mm-hmm. right? Where you see some teams overseas or in the NBA have 10 to 12 for a whole game.
Right.
So like adjusting back to that style of play, you could definitely tell the guys like hadn't been accustomed to that. And then you see the shot selection and like, you know, the percentages in some of those first games were really bad. So, like, that's kind of the only difference. Now, the tournament, because of how it was set up, you know, every team is extremely talented. So, one way or the other, they're going to end up scoring enough points to keep the games closed. There are very few blowouts in the TBT. Mm-hmm. But, like, you could definitely see, like, especially if you know basketball, that, like, they're missing, like, one or two steps. And then by the end of it, you know, probably by the Elite Eight when, you know, we'd played 3 games – you know, every game is now at back to that high level that people are used to.
Cool.
So, yeah, man, that's all we have for you today. We appreciate you coming on, man, and joining us and talking some hoops with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you guys having me.
Yeah, thanks, man.
All right, so that was Ford McGlynn, former Dallas Town area high school basketball player, went on to obviously play Division I and has gone on to do some big things overseas. Appreciate him coming on and talking with us today. So, Mike, why don't we get into a little bit of All In Network stuff, talk about some things we got going on.
Yeah, All In Network. If you missed, Friday was the debut of Real Deal Radio. He had a really cool interview with Leah Rachel. That's on this YouTube channel. And then you can go to his feed for the podcast. It's Real Deal Radio, presented by All In Network. So make sure you're checking that out. All In Politics debuted their first episode. Well, they did an episode with us, and then they posted their debut. They had a really interesting guest, talked about Marxism in America and how that might work. So I learned a lot listening to that. That's on our YouTube channel as well if you want to learn some stuff from them about politics, get informed. They're really good for that, so make sure you're following them, All In Politics. And we also did a joint podcast with Cody Deal talking about his new show, which is on this feed and his feed. So make sure you check that out if you like us and you want to get to know Cody some more before you start listening to him. That'd be a good show for that.
Yeah, man, don't forget to tune in and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Leave a like, comment for those of you tuning in on YouTube. For those of you tuning in on audio, make sure you leave a rating. You can leave comments there as well, and make sure you subscribe, whether that's on Apple, Spotify. You can find us on Google Podcasts and other platforms as well. And yeah, so stay tuned. We have the Reign and Bliss podcast, new episode coming out for them soon. And then Friday we'll have more episodes of the All In Politics and Real Deal Radio coming out for you guys. So make sure you guys subscribe to the channel so you can catch them on YouTube. Or if you're tuning in on audio, make sure you're following on Spotify or Apple or whatever platform streaming podcast. Mm-hmm. But again, we thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of the All In Podcast. And you guys have a great day, night, whenever you're listening. You guys stay cool.
Thanks, guys.